This week, we explore a conundrum about lodges. For those of us out there who have no specific dogma in our religions, if we even have one, could lodge be considered a church? We'll explore this question in great detail. Then, what do female hummingbirds and their flashy feathers have to do with Freemasonry? Here's a clue. Flashy colors equals lapel pins and medals. How do we use those? How do we define titles? And should we get rid of titles altogether? All this and more in this edifying episode of Whence Came You. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back. This is episode number 510. Thanks to our fellows, contributors, producers, and legacy partners for bringing this program to you week after week, month after month, year after year. If you want to know more about how you can help bring this show to brothers and people interested in Freemasonry all over the world, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and see how you can help. I want to thank Denver Lodge number 5 for having me virtually present for their Masonica event, which was really cool. I also want to say that if you're listening to this on Sunday or Monday morning, you might have a chance to check out the same presentation, which is The Legend of Adam's Grave, which I'll be doing again for Scouters Lodge virtually. Details for that will be on the presentation schedule on the website, WCYpodcast.com. We're going to do it at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time. As far as the news goes, lots of stuff going on with that Knight Templar hoopla that has been going on last week. We had great presentations by Brother Oscar Allen on the Refracted Light. I would check that out. He discusses, you know, we shared the news that the CBCS, or I think as they're called, the Great Priory of America, was declared irregular or something along those lines back in the 2010, 11, or 12 era from the Grand Encampment of Knights Templar United States. They went back into Amity a few weeks ago, and so there's been a lot of news about that. So educate yourself on that if you're interested. I'll have links back to that video, which was really cool. I think Brother Oscar did a wonderful job there. So nothing else really going on in the news. Let's go ahead and get into this week's education. Now, the first piece that I wanted to read actually is a piece that I wrote for the Midnight Freemasons, which had a lot of traction on the web. But not in the sense that I was actually hoping to. I guess part of the reason why I don't get the response I'm looking for sometimes is because I might title an article as a question, and people just answer the question instead of reading the article, and then I ask them, did you read the article? And they say, yes, I read the article, but you're still ridiculous. So that's fine, that's fair. So this article that I want to read is called Is Lodge My Church? By Robert Johnson. And I started it off with this quote from Ernest Borgnine, my religion is now Freemasonry. And so right away, you might say, absolutely not. The temple is not a church. It can't be. And I think I agree with that. Let's see where it goes. Recently, our good friend, Brother Alex Powers, posted something interesting on the Kansas Masonry Facebook page. For some background, Alex posts a question for contemplation almost daily. Sometimes they're deep philosophical questions and other times they're more straightforward. If I'm scrolling through Facebook and I see the question, I stop to read it. Sometimes I answer them and sometimes I stop and think about it. Maybe I reply, perhaps not. I almost always answer straightforward questions about my lodge experience or procedures and customs that we might use in lodge. The reason being, it's hoped others might also read the replies and see where their own experiences and traditions are similar or different from the others that they are reading about. This is a great way to see the universality of the craft and create more informed and confident Master Masons. The philosophical questions are a bit different. In fact, earlier this week, Alex posted a question that began with a little admonition. He says, quote, let's start off with this week's theme being one typically avoided in Masonic circles, religion. Obviously, we will approach this in due bounds and remind all to do the same. And of course, our team of moderators will keep an eye on as well. Today's topic, in your personal experience, do you utilize Freemasonry as a supplementary factor to add or to enhance your religious practice? Or do you view and treat Freemasonry entirely separate? This blog's description is a group of Master Masons talk about topics of Masonic interest, each from their own unique perspective. You'll find a wide range of subjects, including history, trivia, travel, book reviews, great quotes, and hopefully a little humor as well on topics of interest for Freemasons and those interested in the subject of Freemasonry, end quote. So, knowing that this was a question about religious practice and lodge, and this blog post is based on my own unique perspective, let's continue. My own perspective is precisely what I want to lay out. I began to answer Alex's prompt, and while doing so, I thought I would keep it simple, but that I would also lay this out for the blog because this is a question that's always out there, looming like some kind of storm cloud. I wish it was easier to talk about things like this without having tons of disclaimers, but alas, it's a hotly debated topic. In fact, what's more hotly debated about is that the question itself shouldn't even be asked. But it was, and here's my answer. I grew up Roman Catholic. I attended church in Naples, Italy, with my mom and dad weekly. My dad was in the service, the Navy to be precise, and had been stationed there. It was a wonderful experience. Later, we came home to the United States. We settled in Illinois after my dad had passed away. I was young, and I attended a Lutheran grammar school for a year also. My mom wasn't a fan and pulled me out. I went to public schools after that. My religious beliefs, until my early 20s, could best be represented by the poster that hung in Fox Mulder's basement office in the X-Files. And in reality, that poster is laminated and hangs on my own office wall right now. I want to believe. I want to believe was my motto with religion and just about anything else. And let's be honest, why wouldn't you want to believe? There would be a certain comfort or contentment in knowing or believing for those out there who don't believe. To be sure, some atheists will say that they are already content and comfortable. I believe you. This speaks for the rest of us. I wasn't an atheist. I was agnostic in those formative years. I found it audacious, in a sense, to declare it one way or the other. Who am I to say whether something like God exists or doesn't? After reading much literature on philosophy, with varied authors and really focusing on my collegiate studies, which were themselves centered on philosophy in religion, I had arrived. I did not have faith that there was more. I knew there was more. I did believe. Because the evidence was surrounding me. The readings and authors that did the most to sway my mind were Giordano Bruno, Gaetano Repole, Thomas Paine, Spinoza, and even Albert Einstein. They convinced me that intelligent design was written, as we say in this fraternity, in the book of nature. I cannot be classified wholly as a deist, although it sometimes fits. To answer the question placed above, where does someone like myself stand? In an age where fewer people are going to church each year, finding an organized religion as fulfilling or are willing to have faith, we ask why. And I think the answer is because they want to know. And while I had the confidence to say that I knew, absolutely, that there was something else, that there was intelligent design, I also understand that having this mindset could be considered a gift. To others, it may be too rigid. For me, it's right. It's right. Whatever your path is, whatever lens you see the world through, or your particular religion, as long as it hurts no one, follow it. So where do I stand on Alex's question? I suppose I see Freemasonry as the living practice of deism, maybe even Stoicism. While we have the Abrahamic faiths as a foundation for the allegory, or rather, it's the mode of transmission we've chosen to use, the tenets of our institution are universal in application. Not one part of it is specifically applicable to only one religion. Hence Freemasonry's secular stance, at least in words. Oftentimes, many members belong to lodges that do have a specific religious flavor. I don't mean to be derogatory, I just don't have a better way to describe it. Other lodges stay as objective and vanilla as possible. Multiple volumes of sacred law on the altar, specifically written prayers that remove themes of one kind or another and more. It really does span the gamut. At this time, regular Freemasonry requires a belief in a supreme being or God. It does so for some precise reasons, which I'm not going to get into here. Deism is a philosophy that has changed over the years very dramatically, so much so that in some jurisdictions, deists aren't allowed to join Freemasonry. Would this have barred members like Benjamin Franklin? Perhaps. But that is not the question asked above. Deism has no church or divinely inspired text or volume of sacred law. It would be nice to have something, I suppose, but what would it be? A volume of sacred law for a deist is probably considered the Book of Nature. This isn't an actual book, of course. It's analogous to saying, look around you. This is my book. This is my divinely inspired text. Deism also has no church. There again, the deist might say, the world is my church. I'm wandering through it. I'm wondering, though, if deism did have a church, perhaps a craft lodge is it. Again, I'm not so sure I'm a deist, and I don't go to religious services often. My opinion here might mean nothing to you as based on that alone. I've said it in a room full of people to whom I was lecturing. Freemasonry is my religion. Yikes, I just said that. You might say to yourself, Freemasonry isn't a religion, it has no God, or it has no path for salvation or redemption. You're right, there is no God in Freemasonry. Its members believe that whatever their individual God is, we can call it the great architect of the universe. For hey, for me, God works. So, I know there's something out there, something bigger, grander, incomprehensible. While I might not have a specific dogma, at times I guess deism is a good banner that fits me. The craft offers me a place to meet others who can agree on a shared belief in an intelligent creator and interact with others who share the same universal beliefs, regardless of their personal backgrounds. Maybe Lodge, for me, is its own religion, even though folks might vehemently disagree. Lodge definitely adds to my dogma. It might just be my church. To quote an interview with Ernest Borgnine for The Scotsman in 2009, quote, his religion now, he says, is Freemasonry. I'm very happy to say that I'm a 33rd degree Grand Cross Master Mason in the Scottish Rite. We believe in one thing, God. We believe in another thing, to help your fellow man. Be as kind as you can be to everybody. End quote. So there you have it. I'm not going to ask the Craftsman Plus if church is your lodge, or if lodge is your church, or even if Freemasonry is your religion. Even if we're not supposed to say that it is. What I'd like to ask instead is Alex's question. For a Craftsman Plus, in your personal experience, do you utilize Freemasonry as a supplementary factor to add to or enhance your religious practice? Or do you view and treat Freemasonry entirely separate, unrelated to your religious personal experience? I look forward to reading your thoughts, and of course, these are mine. I'll put a link back to this post under the question so that you can refer back to it if you so choose. Next up, there's an interesting article in Science News this week, and it seems kind of unrelated, but I think there's something we can learn. The title of the article is Female Hummingbirds May Sport Flashy Feathers to Avoid Being Harassed. It says, it's not all about sex. Pretty plumage can evolve to give other social advantages, scientists say. What follows is a short article about the bright and fanciful colors of a hummingbird and how it can be used to avoid being harassed by other animals, birds, insects, those kinds of things. And it got me thinking about flashy things. So if we think about nature, we have a variety of animals that all have warning signs or colors or markings that tend to make them stand out, as something about them is important. Think about the bands on a snake. Or, in this case, these hummingbirds. So they wear colors to not be harassed. Well, in Freemasonry, we kind of do this too. Maybe for two reasons. Ego, look at me, I got the thing. Or for some, it may be something to strive toward for this exact reason. So that you don't get harassed. Is it easier to get things done if you have rank? I think so. Let's talk about Freemasonry and the titles. And more often than not, when we get those titles, there's some sort of a jewel that we wear or a special pin that makes us stand out, that we're advertising for something. Now, are we advertising for that group in particular? Like, let's say it's an invitational body. You're not really advertising a group that you're an invitational body. You're saying, I'm in this, and you're not. Aren't we? Or is it to drive interest and still say, you might have interest, but you're not getting in unless you get invited? So maybe it says, work hard. What are we actually saying with these jewels? What are we actually saying about titles? There was a really cool advice column that came out from a publication online called Ladders, Fast on Your Feet. And this particular piece was called Why Job Titles Get in the Way of Growth in the Workplace. Let's take a look at this and see what it means for Freemasonry. We don't know how attached we are to something until we let it go. As I finished delivering my keynote, the room wasn't just filled with applause. The entire floor was covered with small pieces of paper. The audience loved your talk, but the cleaning people will hate you, one of the organizers told me, laughing. I was invited to speak about the democratization of leadership in agile organizations, or attached to our desired job titles. Our attachment to our desired job titles inhibits organizational growth. That's why I encouraged people to let go of it, both physically and metaphorically. I asked participants to write down their name and job title, and then, all at the same time, tear their business card saying at once, I'm no longer blank their job title. I'm just their name. So, I'm no longer Robert Johnson, host of a podcast. I'm just Robert Johnson. I've facilitated this exercise several times before. However, watching close to 1,000 people letting go of their title attachments simultaneously was a powerful and energizing experience. We usually don't realize how much we suffer until we get rid of what was causing the pain. You are not your title. The ability to drive change is not directly correlated to a title. Everyone in the organization has the responsibility and capacity to lead. Most people let a job title define their identity, self-esteem, status, and more. That's why we get attached to that line underneath our name. We want our fair share of recognition. However, we are more than just a title. People's contributions shouldn't be limited to the positions they hold. Job titles tend to create divisions rather than foster collaboration. Tearing one's business card is a powerful icebreaker to level set a team. It creates awareness of how titles get in our way. Everyone acknowledges the elephant in the room. Letting go of one's title, both mentally and physically, is a powerful way to release that emotional pressure. But most importantly, it sends a clear message. We encourage the team to prioritize quality over egos. An idea matters more than who authored it. Embrace your vulnerability. Don't hide behind your title. I remember consulting a university in Europe. The CEO was frustrated with its toxic culture. Quote, they are all backstabbers and passive-aggressive, end quote. I remember her telling me during our first call, they can't see each other in the eye. Not surprisingly, during the first team offsite, she was the only one who couldn't tear her card. Even her direct reports had no problem of letting go of theirs. Everyone was willing to become more vulnerable in front of each other, except her. I'm not judging this woman. She couldn't take the challenge. It was easier for her to blame the team. Letting go of one's title is not about making us all equal, but about sharing accountability. The entire team owns the problem and is responsible for solving it. So the article goes on to list 5 ways to overcome the title bias. Now, in Freemasonry, we think about this. We know that these titles exist, that right worshipful, worshipful, most worshipful, all of these titles, illustrious or whatever it is. And we keep these titles, but we always say to ourselves, but just call me brother. Well, if that's the case, then why do we have those titles at all? Does it give us some special powers to have those titles? I think it does and it doesn't, but let's check out these 5 ways to overcome the title bias. Number 1, titles inhibit candor. Most people feel intimidated by their bosses. A Harvard Business Review survey reveals that most people trust a stranger more than their manager. Psychological safety is key to encourage people to speak up without the fear of being judged or punished. Building trust takes time and must be nurtured continually. Keep an eye on how safe your team feels. Do your team members speak up, or do they censor their best ideas? Be mindful of both your verbal and nonverbal cues. Are you promoting or hindering open conversations? Saying the organization is safe but not paying full attention can be perceived as you are dismissive. Number 2, titles create an authority bias. This one is pretty huge. The opinion of the boss promotes groupthink. Once their manager speaks up, most people change their opinions. If you are the most senior executive in the room, be the last one to speak up to avoid the authority bias. Make sure everyone shares their opinion before you do. If you're anxious, capture your thoughts on a post-it. Listen and pay attention. Don't let your perspective become everyone's way of thinking. We're so guilty of this one in Freemasonry because usually the worshipful master leads the meeting, so the Grand Master sets the tone for something, and from that point on, it is that opinion to which we are supposed to be completely adherent to. Number 3, titles feed the illusion of power. This is also another big one. Most organizations correlate titles to authority. Being the boss equals being right. Most people have an issue with embracing their own vulnerability. They use a title to protect themselves. Global studies reveal that 79% of people quit their jobs for lack of appreciation. When you don't need to protect a perfect image of you as a leader, it's easier to value the good within your team members. Reflect, is your self-image getting in your way? Number 3, being the boss equals being right. Well, in the fraternity, being the boss does not equal being right. It means you're the boss and this is your decision, and regardless of being right or wrong, people have to abide by it. Which just means that the weight of being on the right side of history and doing the right thing is even more important. Number 4, titles protect comfort zones. The lack of title is way out. It's a common excuse for not taking on more responsibilities and to expect someone else to do the things for us. Titles protect us from stretching beyond our comfort zone. Senior managers use them to hide their vulnerability. Those in their lower ranks don't step up because they don't have the right title. What about you? Think about this one in the terms of the fraternity. Our worshipful masters typically don't do a whole lot unless they're super engaged, right? We throw the tasks out to the lodge, and yet without giving them a title, they don't actually step up to do the work. We see this all over the United States with things like DEOs or district education officers. While we appease them with a title, they don't actually get anything official. They're not valued the same way, say, a DDGM would be, which is a mistake. So perhaps there's something to be said there. And finally in this article, it says number 5, titles hide our blind spots. Senior executives, let's call it worshipful masters, see differently. They observe the whole picture and visualize a better future. However, that asset can also blind them. They assume everyone sees what they see. For example, 89% of bosses believe employees quit because they want more money, but only 12% of employees actually leave for that reason. Letting go of your title is also about not being blinded by your position. It's acknowledging the gap between the perspective and your teams. Make sure everyone's on the same page rather than assuming they see what you do. So in this instance, right, a worshipful master might come in, set his plans for the whole year, and not explain why that's his plan. But to get everybody involved and to have some skin in the game, maybe it behooves him to go through that plan and express why this is so important for him or for the lodge. So if you want to read this article for yourself, I'll post a link to it in the show notes. It's by Gustavo Rossetti, and he's a change instigator that helps teams lead positive change. He's an author, a consultant, a speaker on team development and cultural transformation. The article was first published on Medium. So here we've addressed some issues with title. Now, in another article that I thought was really interesting came directly out of the Wall Street Journal. The title is, What's in a Title? Ego Stroking, Chiefly. Can Too Many Chiefs Spoil a Title? Is the first part of the line. The article really identifies the fact that all a title really does is ego stroke. And I'm sure within the idea of a Masonic lodge, right? In our fraternity, one of the things that we try to break is the individual ego, which is kind of counterintuitive thinking and in the practice of actually handing out titles. So that's one side of the coin. Now, the other side of the coin is, of course, to strive to get these titles for a completely different reason. Personally, as I worked hard to attain a job title with my Grand Lodge as a District Deputy Grand Master, my chief concern, of course, aside from the regular duties of a DDGM, which were of the utmost importance in serving my Grand Lodge, was to prop up the District Education Officer. I wanted to make Masonic education the biggest priority in my district. So rather than, yay, look at me, I tried to be a set of stairs or stepping stones or shoulders to stand on for anybody else to get in front of the masses of Freemasonry and deliver quality content that would bring them back to Lodge every single week or month. So for many of us, this is an option. We work hard in order to have this shiny new lapel pin or this jewel on our breast so that when we do something, nobody questions it. Or if they do, it's, you know, nothing serious. You get the authority to do the things that need to be done, and you have little or no recourse but what exists in a few naysayers out there. If they say, Brother John Paul Jones has always been about education and he's now the Grand Master of Freemasonry, and now he says Masonic education is the thing to focus on, who is going to argue with that? Going back to the title, where as a Grand Master what you say is right, regardless of whether or not it is right, it allowed you in that position to make those decisions. So in this case, you could work hard for a title to get buy-in. And the converse side to that is that getting the boss to buy in to your idea allows you, without climbing the ranks, to enact that plan. And that's just what was written about in the Harvard Business Review, which appeared in the magazine in the January-February issue 2015. It was called Getting the Boss to Buy In, Managing Up. Now, I'll just read you the summary. For organizations to prosper, managers in the middle ranks must feel empowered to identify and promote the need for change. So, in this instance, I want you to think about you. You're all the managers in middle ranks. You're all craft masons. Continuing on, people at this level gather valuable intelligence from direct contact with customers, suppliers, and colleagues. They can often see when the market is ripe for a certain offering, for instance, or spot signs that a partnership won't work. So, addressing this in Masonry, the members of the lodge are in direct contact with the profane world and with other lodge members. And they have their finger on the pulse of things, whether that be online, what's coming down the pipeline from Grand Lodge, or in the community. Continuing on, but for many reasons, ranging from fear or negative consequences to compliance with the top-down culture, they may not voice their ideas and concerns, and even when they do, they often struggle to persuade the people at the top. Sound familiar? I know it does in my neck of the woods, and in a lot of other places around the United States. Now, the author studied issue selling in a range of organizations, roles, and industries, identifying 7 tactics associated with success. Managers should tailor their pitch to their goals, values, and knowledge of decision makers. Frame the issue to show how it supports a strategic goal. Manage emotions, their own and their audiences. Get the timing right by, say, attending to a boss's preoccupation or watching larger trends. Involve others, both in and out of their networks. Adhere to organizational norms, such as how leaders prefer to receive information, and suggest solutions, or at least propose ways to find one. Issue selling is an ongoing process that requires groundwork and patience. Mid-level managers who do it effectively get decision makers' attention and make a real difference in their organizations. So basically, what this is saying is all of you are these managers. We're all managers in a lodge. And to get the boss's buy-in to move to an organizational change or to do something new at your lodge, you need to approach it in a way, and you have good timing, so know when to speak up. You need to attend to the boss's preoccupations, which means tailor your message around what your boss or the worshipful master, whoever your audience is, to something that they're interested in. For instance, maybe you didn't get anywhere with planning a poker night, and maybe the master of your lodge is really looking at charity as his thing this year. So how do you spin that? Well, maybe the proceeds go to the charity. You got to find a way to tie it into something that they want also. And you need to present that information in a way that they like to present it. Maybe they want a phone call, maybe they want an email, maybe they want a full-blown presentation at the lodge. But it's your job as a manager of your own lodge to bring these things up for change. Your second Craftsman Plus question for this week is, what is your motivation behind getting a title? Or are you even concerned with titles? Many of us are not. But I think for those of us who are going to try to make a difference in this fraternity, it should be something on your radar. Not for your own personal gain, but to be a force for good within the fraternity. I'd love to hear your thoughts about this. Go ahead and put them in the Craftsman Plus group right underneath the writing prompt, and I'll try to catch up on those throughout the week. That's it for this week. I want to thank you all for coming with me on this episode of Whence Came You. I hope you learned a little something. I hope you thought deeply about some of these concepts. I'll have links to all of the articles that I talked about in the show notes. And one last time, I want to give a big shout out to our contributors, our fellows, producers, and legacy partners. Without you, we cannot do this program. And if you are out there and you're listening and you've been listening and you're on the YouTube channels and you've subscribed and you've done all the things and you've shared with your friends and family and your lodge members and you're thinking, how can I help the WCY podcast? Well, the answer is simple. Just go on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on support the show, and check out the options. We've got a number of things you can do to assist the program. We've even got some things for sale on the shop, so check it all out. Every dollar goes right back into this program and the ability to produce great content for all of you in search of Masonic light or who are interested in the Masonic fraternity. I'll talk to you all next week. Until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.